Hi, this is Dhruv Ghanekar. I'm a composer, producer, guitar player based in India. And I've just released my new album called Dhruv Voyage 2, which I urge you to go and listen to. And you are listening to Stalwarts of Music by Aditya Veera. So, yes, do check it out. Thank you.
Hi, Dhruv. Namaste. Welcome to Stalwarts of Music with Aditya Veera, Season 3. It's an incredible privilege to have you on the show finally.
Yes, thanks for having me, Aditya. I've been watching your episodes. It's been actually, I've seen your, journey right from the time you started. So it's been great. I'm really enjoying it, and thanks for having me.
Well, how was the conference? I'd like to start with the All About Music conference, and what were some of the highlights that really appealed to you? What are some of the topics of interest in this year's conference?
So I actually landed up being there just for the last day. I wasn't there for the first 2 days. Unfortunately, I was working and I was busy with something else. I made it for the third day. So my, Deepak, who is a Grammy-winning engineer, he is mixing my album in Atmos. So
Oh, lovely.
yeah, so he was doing a session, in fact, at the festival. At the conference, sorry. And so he had kind of invited me to come and kind of, just be there and listen to it and just, talk a bit. And so that's basically how I landed up going there. It was also my first time that I've been for the conference. So, I mean, I was actually quite blown away by how, superbly it's organized. And, TM has done an amazing job with it. It's also the testament, I think, to the fact that the music in the Indian music business, Indian music industry is now into the next phase of, of professionalism, where it's not just, earlier, and I've been for many of these kind of conferences before, during when we were doing Blue Frog, you'd get invited for these kind of things. So I would always find that these conferences were mostly B2B, and as they, most of them are really B2B. They are like business to business. And this one is more like front facing. It's much more like facing towards musicians. A lot of musicians, everybody's there to network. A lot of people in the music fraternity, a lot of journalists, a lot of publishers. So it's not only the business side, but it's also the front facing side. I think eventually it will evolve into becoming a South by Southwest-ish.
Oh, nice.
I think so, because that's the way it should go, because the whole landscape is changing, right now. It's things are moving very fast in the music business. So I was very impressed.
Amazing. So I'm sure there's a lot of progress in terms of this entire entity sort of expanding its wings into something similar in the lines of South by Southwest.
I mean,
That being
I hope so. I think that should be the ambition for TM, because the way it's laid out right now, and for that to happen, of course, they will need, sponsorship and bigger numbers, and then they will have to open it up and make it wider. They'll have to bring like more like festivalish sort of programming into it, and all the things that usually happen around a big festival. But I think the sky's the limit, and it's a good time to be in, in India, to be part of the music scene.
Certainly, certainly. And I'd like to start the agenda for today talking about the topic of interest. Firstly, congratulations on this lovely album.
Thank you.
I would like to understand, when you approach creating the album Dhruv Voyage 2, do you find yourself in bursts of inspiration writing specifically for this project? Or is your songwriting more of an ongoing process where the pieces come together over a period of time? What approach do you find most effective in this particular context?
Yeah, I think it's more, it's kind of sporadic, because the problem that I face, and maybe this is only my problem, is that because I do a lot of different things apart from, creating my own music. I'm a composer on call for a lot of media work. So the problem I find is kind of jumping between those two things, and they're very different things. When you're composing music for commercial work, and this, it's a different challenge. But I've kind of kept that kept, you know, writing my own music, you know, going over the, over all these years.
Yeah.
It usually picks up momentum as I have to usually set a deadline for it. So first of all, I'm terrible with finishing. I think a lot of most creative people are terrible at with finishing their own music. And I think that comes with not having external deadlines.
Correct.
So the first thing that I usually do is I'll set a like a sort of a pencil deadline. You know, you'll sort of say that this is the date. And then that date can move slightly depending on other things when you get closer to it, like production related things. But I think it's important to set the deadline. So that's what I did this year. I did it, I should have done it earlier.
Okay.
But last year I set up my label. And that's why it's taken. I wanted this to be my fourth, a third or fourth release and not the very first one out of the door. Because we wanted to set up the systems and all that stuff for the label. So coming back to Voyage. So I think the creative process of it is kind of, it goes between having bursts of, you know, inspiration where you write, you want to work with certain artists and then those artists become available to you. And this has been a deeply collaborative project, as you've heard and you know. There are a lot of artists on this. That collaboration actually happens. It doesn't always happen easily because people, after COVID, a lot of people have moved out of the city. You know, people are not available sometimes for long periods of time, either they're traveling or they're touring. So you make a shortlist of people that you want to work with, and then you kind of try and find, you know, find them if they are available to you. A lot of times I will write excess amount of music. So for this album, there are lots of songs that didn't make it to the album, not because they are bad or anything, or not because they are, they just, I wanted the sound of the album to be more, you know, of a celebration, and I wanted it to be more groove oriented. And some of the other songs were a little more cerebral. You know, one of the songs was slightly more cerebral, and it wouldn't like sort of fit into the, you know, the flow of the of all the songs. So it kind of goes back and forth. I think the momentum is very important when you're doing an album, and that momentum you have to sort of agree on certain things with yourself and impose it upon yourself. If you don't impose it, then you know things take forever to finish otherwise. Yeah,
I like the whole aspect of how you've kind of, you know, set these deadlines and then tried to, you know, achieve them within a certain stipulated time frame. And another interesting facet was the whole idea behind sequencing, or shall we say, you know, sorting out the songs all the way from Suprabhat to, you know, It Takes Its Course, right? And you also mentioned the whole idea of sticking to a particular theme, right? And keeping that in mind.
Yeah.
So how do you sort of take a call as to what will fit into this album and what can be done at a later point, probably in the next cycle of things? How do you decide that?
So, see, there are two lenses through which you can see this album, this project. The first lens is an internal thing which I wanted it to be, and that came out of learnings from the first Voyage album. So we toured, you know, quite a bit after we finished the first Voyage album. We played a lot of festivals in India. We played festivals abroad. And one of the big learnings was that, you know, people generally at music festivals, they want to groove and dance and they want to have fun. Basically, everyone's there to, like, you know, have a good time. And there is very little space for, like, you know, very intense cerebral music, or if the music is too challenging, people just don't, you know, it becomes a little tricky to, you know, kind of appeal to people. So the first thing for me was to kind of create, I wanted to do a groove album straight out. You know, I didn't want it to be intense and, you know, like sort of very sort of muso only oriented music. I wanted it to have a wide appeal. I want people to enjoy it, but I want the arrangements and I want the musicality of the album to be interesting and hip. I don't want to compromise on that. So, I mean, so that's something personal to me. And the signature of this Voyage project is making, you know, taking folk music from India and giving it a global face. So collaborating with global artists. So that's the first part of it, which is the more groove-oriented, musical-oriented, you could say, lens. The second lens is that, which actually happened by, you know, coincidence or whatever you want to call it, is that it's a woman-oriented album. So all the voices in the album are all women. So that was sort of, you could say, divine intervention. I didn't intend it to be like that. Normally, when I'm, you know, producing my own music, I also sing quite a bit in it. I sang on a few songs in the last one. This one, I kind of didn't feel like singing because the voices on the album are so big and they're so complete in itself. There was no space for me to kind of, I mean, one song, you know, Devri, it's, I've kind of, you know, sung on the chorus of it. But other than that, it's a woman-oriented album. And the idea was to give, you know, the voices of women from folk cultures, give them a sort of a global pedestal and give them sort of a stage where they can stand on globally. So those were the, like, the big stroke sort of ideas around this album. And then, you know, of course, we can talk in more detail about, you know, all the other intricate stuff which is there. And there's lots of fun stuff which we had. Every song is a story in itself, actually, you know.
Right. Would it be accurate to say that in your latest album, the women emerge as a more self-reliant and, shall we say, resilient figures, demonstrating strength that perhaps surpasses that of men? So I'd like to basically understand what prompts the positioning of women in this album.
So, like I said, it was not intentional. I think it evolved into that. I am also surrounded by women in my life, you know. Yeah. I have two daughters, you know, my wife, my mother-in-law is an accomplished singer herself. My mother is also has a big influence on my, you know, personal life and my music. And, you know, so I've kind of, you know, always been around, you know, strong women, I guess, and I'm comfortable with it. It does not, like, in any way, I don't feel threatened, or it's not in any way, I don't see any negativity around that.
Right.
I think for music, you kind of, you should not, I don't believe you should kind of see things like that. I mean, often you will get a brief with where you will, you know, and those briefs are external. It's, you know, sometimes you will get, if you're doing a song for, or like an anthem song for some, you know, a woman's charity and or those kind of things. Those are more external briefs. For Voyage, it wasn't like that, to be honest, to begin with. But it just so happened, it kind of evolved into becoming this thing. So yes, it was not intentional, but I'm happy the way it's turned out. You know, it's kind of turned out, and each and every, you know, artist on the album, right from Kalpana Patovari to Nandini to Vaishali to, of course, Ila Ji, you know, they're all powerhouses. They're all incredible singers in their own right. But the difference is that they've never been heard in this context before.
Mm.
Context is also important in when you're creating an album or you're creating a project that has one sound. So there are a lot of different genres, yes, but I think the cohesive aspect of it is that there are women and all the songs are sort of celebration of, you know, grooves, you could say, of, you know, and different kinds of music from India. So it's Indian based music,
correct,
but it's sort of very global in its sort of, you know, in the way
approach.
It's flavored.
Another recurring theme, if we had to consider both the shall we say, incarnations, right? You had, of course, Dhruv Voyage, and then the second version of it, right? So I noticed that there is this very unique ability of yours to externalize very complex internal landscapes through your music, right? If we look at it as a common strand between these two, phases. So would it be right to say that it's a recurring theme or an intention running through these two albums?
So the complexity comes from, you know, my own wanting to make things interesting for myself. It's not a forced thing. I don't go around saying, okay, let's see how we can make this, you know, tricky. It's not at all like that. It's more about, you know, I think it's also for me a counter to all the commercial music that I do. You know, it's very important for me to satisfy and to kind of, you know, water this other side of me, which is, you know, the muso sort of, if you want to call it that, that part of me, which I, you know, I listen to music, you know, I mean, I listen to so much of different music. I grew up listening to so much of different music, right? From like jazz to a lot of like fusion and, you know, jazz rock, of course, and then Indian music and Indian classical. And so I think, that's just the way my brain just kind of cooks different things. So those influences which are there, which have been there in my sort of, you know, so have been my early influences in my teens, sort of those triggering sort of, you know, seminal influences which changed my life. You want to also always at some point want to pay respect to your you know heroes and you know people that you love. So this music for me is kind of a celebration of that as well, and me sort of tipping the hat to my heroes and people that I love grew up listening to. So even though it is Indian music, I don't want it to be dumbed down. So I don't like, that's my, you know, issue with a lot of times when you do a fusion album is people tend to dumb down the music. It doesn't have, you know, it kind of starts becoming very linear and has this sort of one chord approach, which for me is not that interesting. You know, it is, it's maybe for some people that's interesting, but for me, it's not. I like to kind of have things more keeping things moving harmonically interesting as well as rhythmically. So, and I think there's a place for doing that, like for doing more linear stuff. And in fact, there is one song on this album, which is, you know, Nacho, which is sort of like that. It's this hypnotic one beat, which goes through the entire song.
Correct.
No. So it really, I think a lot of it depends on the song and it depends on what the inspiration was at that point. Yeah. So, you know, every song has its own story. Like I said, you know, Devri was a song that evolved over a long, like over a large period of time. It took me a long time to agree on that arrangement also.
Okay.
And also the other thing is quite often, which is a problem is with me, is I land up doing like multiple arrangements of the same song. So I'll do like 2-3 different, I'll try to like properly fleshed out arrangements where I'll play everything and, you know, and then I'll agree on one which I want to kind of, you know, move with and sort of, you know, take forward to the next level. Because as you know, producing songs is expensive also because you have to hire music.
Sure, of course.
So before you can commit to, you know, doing it, doing the full-fledged production, I think it's interesting to kind of play around with different things and see how it sounds, you know. So to kind of, you, at least you feel satisfied. So that takes time, unfortunately, you know, you can't rush that process.
And on an average, if we had to sort of gauge the number of different arrangements that you had put forth for each particular song, what's the benchmark like? When do you feel content, or when do you feel convinced that this is all set to be put out to the public?
There is no formula, unfortunately. I'll give you a couple of examples. Like Suprabhatam, for example. I started off with Suprabhatam. I instantly, I heard, I mean, of course, everybody has heard Suprabhatam from their childhood. In India, you grow up, you listen to that, especially in South India. It's something which you kind of, you know, you grow up with. So for me, the first time I heard it was, you know, when I went as a child. But I mean, that was not such a deep memory for me. The powerful memory for me was when I had actually gone to Tirupati. I had heard it, like, this was like, you know, maybe 15, 16, 17 years back. 2004, maybe 2003. And I remember hearing it early in the morning. And I was like, you know, I was like, it was like, you know, something hit you in the stomach. You, when you hear it, it's being sung like that in a big, large space. So it's kind of been gnawing at me for a long time. But I heard the Bangalore Sisters recording of it. So, which is the shloka that we've used for this. And I instantly heard it with drum and bass in my mind. So, you know, when you, I heard the shloka, I don't know, I always felt like, I just heard it with that beat because it's like a 12-8 kind of thing. So that happened very fast, you know, that instantly I heard it and I called Nandini. I said, we have to record this. I've got this idea. So I programmed some beats and we kind of recorded the vocals. And then I got scared. I just had cold feet. I was like, shit, I'm going to get like, you know, assassinated. People are going to come after me if I do something as blasphemous as this. I didn't know. Like, you know, there's this whole
kind purist of mentality. Country.
Yeah. I mean, people sometimes react, you know, really harshly to things they don't like. But Somashekhar ji, who's the Konakol artist, I sent it to him after many months of this sort of sitting on the arrangement. Because I really wasn't sure whether I should record it. And I sent it to him just... I said, let him hear it, and he heard it and he instantly said like, wow, this is amazing. It's a completely fresh take on it. Let's record it. So that kind of gave me some kind of, you know, validation. I said, okay, fine. This is not, you know, it's not going to be as severe as I think it is. And then Abhay played on it and, you know, he is incredible. He also loved it. So sometimes it takes, you know, an external validation for you to kind of feel like, okay, this is working. And, you know, I have certain people in my corner. Like my brother is, you know, Joy, who is an amazing, has an amazing ear for music. He doesn't live here. He lives in the US. But I often send him stuff and he'll listen to it and he'll tell me like, you know, no, this sucks. Like, you know, try this or whatever. He'll give me a really unmusical sort of a, you know, response to it. But I think it's sometimes it's important to have that, you know, just like a layman's perspective. So there is no hard and fast rule. Coming back to your question about how long something would take. Devri, I've done two arrangements of. There's the second arrangement is still there. It's like a rock fusion sort of a drums, bass, guitar kind of arrangement. And it's cool. It works. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. What other song? I think most of the other songs. Sorothia has two or three arrangements, which are there. They're like kind of okay. I'm sure there's like two arrangements of every song. You know, except for maybe Rasia, which is like this John Scofieldish song. It's got this Martin Medeski Wood Scofield kind of a vibe, which is kind of, again, you hear a song and you instantly feel, you know, a connection. You hear the groove in your head. So that's what I heard when I heard this singer, you know, from Rajasthan. I heard her on YouTube actually, and when I heard the beat, I just felt like this is exactly what needs to be done. So a lot of times, you know, you'll hear the entire thing almost like not finished, but
yeah,
you hear the melody and you hear how it sounds juxtaposed against a different sort of a groove. So, I mean, my mind just kind of works like that now. I guess I'm just like a DJ, you know. I think like a DJ. I'll think of something and I'll kind of immediately, my mind will go to how it might sound with, you know, this other thing that I've also, that's kind of cooking in my head. So once that process, I kind of start feeling it's more natural and I start feeling, you know, more organically, I start leaning towards it. And you have to lean into it a little bit. You can't just like say, you know, like, oh, is this going to like work or it does not. You have to lean into it. You have to push it. You have to record it. You have to take those first steps, you know. And once you take those first steps, then I think you will either know immediately whether it sucks, like it's terrible, or whether you should kind of move forward with it.
In terms of the level of appreciation, you did mention that you're being validated by a lot of people who are around you, right? But any musician or any artist for that matter looks for a certain level or a certain element of appreciation, right? So as an artist, what is the element of appreciation you look for in terms of this album? Are you looking for people to understand what you've intended to do in terms of the music? Or you just would like them to have a pleasurable experience and feel whatever they'd like to feel while listening to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be a lie to say that, you know, you don't care about the audience. Of course, I think it's important to have external validation. That's why we even bother to record and go through all this process of, you know, doing all this.
Right.
But I don't make music thinking of an audience. You know, I have to like it first. So if I don't like it, then there's no, then it doesn't go forward, doesn't go beyond that. So first you have to like it. Like as a musician, I have to agree on, and be sort of, I have to be happy with the aesthetics of what, you know, how it's shaping up. And things take a while to shape up. Sometimes the way the music is recorded also has changed so much in the last 30, 40 years. You know, production techniques allow us to finesse and detail things far more than even then in the last 10, 20 years, I would say, much more now. So, yes, you want the audience to kind of like it, and you want people to appreciate your work, of course, but that's not the intent. That's not the reason why I will create something. That is secondary. You put it out, of course, with your best, you know, intention, and you hope for the best, of course, and then you just wait and watch. And I think, you know, for this particular album, because it is kind of, it doesn't fit into a box. You know, it's neither Indian music nor is it Western. You know, it's not fusion, but it doesn't have a conventional sort of a label to it. It's global music. I would say that's the easiest way to, you know, kind of label it. It's music which is global in its nature. It's got Indian. Yes, it's Indian, but it's also very, very Western in the way it's kind of wrapped. The wrapping is very Western, I would say.
And you did touch upon the production side of things. From what I noticed, the production of this album seems a little more complex and adventurous, right? And if I had to compare it with your earlier work, there's certainly a lot of familiarity in terms of the sound that you're trying to convey to the listeners when they've already gotten a flavor of Dhruv Ganekar, right? And there's this overall sensibility and a thematic thread that runs through everything. And of course, you spoke of all the incredible musicians, you know, who were part of this recording, all the way from Ilaji to Taufik Ji, and then Vaishali Samant, Nandini. You've had a terrific lineup of artists come together for this one. I definitely hear some textures and studio techniques that are new to your recordings, right? Could you speak a little bit about that?
I'm trying to think. I think maybe what you're talking about is there's a slight, like, more electronic,
correct,
edge to it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, I mean, that's kind of intentional because, again, you know, one listens to so much music and you can't help but be influenced by it. You know, from Skrillex to, you know, whoever. I mean, there's so much of music out there now, and which is on tap, really. You basically get, you listen to everything. And, you know, so I could try and bring something into this sound, you know, not to overpower it, but just to kind of bring a little bit of that flavor. So I think that's kind of been an evolution for me in the last, like, I would say 7-8 years, but it's not so overt. Like, I'm still kind of, I have to restrain myself, honestly, because there's this other side of me, which when I'm doing music, which is more, you know, for commerce, which is film and advertising, for that, you know, it's much more overt over there because the sound needs to be much more wider and it needs to be more mass appeal there. This one is more engineered towards performing live for me. So even the production of the album, I've kind of kept it, tried to keep it in a way that I can replicate it. So that's very important because the intention of this album is to perform this live, and it's going to be a fantastic live album to, you know, to come and experience, because it's a groove oriented album. So, you know, I want it to first, as musicians, to have fun on stage. And I also want the audience to also enjoy and groove and listen to the music. So it's important that that's there. I think the other thing which is maybe been an evolution from the first one is, the arrangements, yeah, they are more intricate. There's more, like, sort of more movement in the arrangements. There's also, like, you know, I've used, there's a horn section almost in every other song.
Yeah.
That's been there because I've also, the last one, you know, I met this friend of mine now who's also on this one, and he's going to be playing with us live. Arthur, who's this amazing Armenian sax player, he's going to be with the band. So, you know, you want to kind of give all the musicians on stage things to do and to perform, and, you know, and so that they're not just waiting between 4 or 5 songs to play, you know, just a few things. So, again, I think the influences were also coming from, like, you know, jazz and Cuban influences. So I wanted, and Balkan music also, which is has been a big influence for me over the last few years. So there's a lot of the Balkan sound which is there. I worked with this fantastic trumpet player from Boston, and he's played on a bunch of tracks on the album. So these are all new influences which have been there, and, you know, I've been kind of wanting to incorporate that into, you know, my new music, and it's found its way very organically, you know, into this. So I'm happy with the way it's turned out, and I'm happy you caught it, actually.
And you also, earlier during our conversation, you mentioned that the Dolby Atmos has been a major proponent in terms of this particular release. So what were some of the key considerations at a very mundane level, if you'd like to explain to my listeners, while making a recording Dolby Atmos worthy? How do you do that?
So I'm not the best person to answer this question, because we just did a talk, in fact, with Deepak, who's the mix engineer. But let me try and give you an analogy for the way Dolby Atmos works. So before you get to Dolby Atmos, you usually mix the album in stereo, which is how we normally consume it. You consume it in left and right stereo. Once you've agreed on those mixes and you've kind of closed that part of the process, then you usually do a mix which is an Atmos mix, which is essentially a 7.1 mix, which is essentially how you consume music in a theater when you're watching a movie. So Dolby Atmos is immersive sound. It's called also called spatial sound in Apple Music. Immersive also it's called. So it has various names. Essentially, it's you have to kind of see it like if you've constructed a house and this is my house of Dhruv Voyage, I am adding another 4 bedrooms around it. So 1, 2, 3, 4. Now this is my house and I've added. So I've added more space around it. So I'm going to take my house and I'm going to kind of open it up like this. But there are 2-3 problems that happen when you do that. One is that your integrity of your stereo mix gets changes. So when you're listening to music in stereo, you're hearing everything more centered like this. And left and right, that's it. So this is your spectrum. But with Atmos, it becomes like this. Mm. Right. So you can push things at the back and you can push things on the side and, you know, in the front, of course. So it changes the way you are listening to music in the sense you'll have things moving around your head. So it's incredible, actually, to listen to it like that. But you have to be careful in not getting absolutely carried away and going bonkers and just start flying things around left and right, because it's not necessary for all kinds of music, you know. I think it works most efficiently in movies, because movies demand that, because it's a visual. Essentially, you're watching something and then you're experiencing the sound or a bullet flying from left to right. But in music, you've kind of got to be a bit more restrained and more prudent about those decisions. But it's been a great experience for me to kind of mix this in Atmos with, and work with Deepak. So the other thing we are doing is we're also entering this for the Grammys. And,
oh, lovely.
Yeah, so the album is going to be in multiple categories for the Grammys this year. And Atmos is, of course, we are going to be entering it for in immersive sound as well in that category.
Good luck with the Grammys. Yes. Really Thank hoping you. That it qualifies to the next round and yes. be you. A breakthrough for someone representing our Indian diaspora there.
Yes, thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. And you also did mention about, you know, the whole idea of not really appealing to the mainstream. If I had to ask you, how would you categorize this particular album in the context of the mainstream? Where would you place it?
I don't think I don't want to appeal to the mainstream. I don't think I've ever said that. But I wanted this album to be for everyone, really. It's not like I'm saying it's not. I don't want to be sound elitist about it at all. The only thing for me is, while you're making an album which is sort of, you know, mainstream-ish, I won't even call it, it's not really a mainstream album in a conventional sense. I mean, for me, it's important to kind of manage my own musical, you know, expectations, or, you know, I just want to have fun essentially making it, and I don't want it to be dumbed down. Those are the two things which are very important, you know, because there is so much music out there, and most of the music that we consume in India is film music, let's be honest, you know, and then the other half is, you know, independent music, which is mostly pop. So this is not film music, and this is certainly not pop music, but it's kind of, I mean, I don't know how to describe it. I think it's Indian music with Indian influences, but it also has like global influences. So it's mainstreamish in that sense, but it's also very, it's intricate and detailed as well. We'll be right back.
being in a digital world right now, how do you feel it resonates with new listeners in 2024, especially for those of them who haven't discovered you as yet?
Yeah.
And how relevant is it for a newer audience, not the set of people who've already been listening to you over the years? How would you like to approach that?
So are you saying how relevant is it to new audiences?
Correct.
Or like you mean like the Gen Zs?
Yeah, not just the Gen Zs. I mean, any category of people who are listening it probably for the first time. How would you like them to consume this kind of music? Or how would they add relevance? Or how can they relate to something like this?
I don't know if I can answer that for them. I think it's each to his own. I think everybody has their own way of listening to music.
Correct.
I think it's not. I mean, I don't think it's the music. The album is not that complicated. Actually, it's very easy to listen to. I've tried to make it as easy to listen to and as interesting at the same, and keeping it musically interesting at the same time. You know, so. But the response has been phenomenal, actually. And not just in India, but you know, also I've been getting messages from, you know, folks in the US and you know in Europe. So the response has been quite amazing. I'm actually quite blown away by the response. And we are about to now, you know, embark on kind of, you know, doing some radio work in the US, trying to get radio play in the US as well. So that's kind of something that we are also pushing now from this month onwards.
And what does it take or what does it entail to get your music on international radio? Do you need a specific license or something of that sort?
No. So you work with an agency that has a network of people of radio stations that they work with, and you usually you kind of work with them and they kind of help you. Essentially, it's like breaking into a new market. So for in order for you to do that, you have to work with somebody who's from that market, who has an understanding of that market. So we're working with a couple of people in the US to help us do that, basically.
And is the consumption on radio internationally much better than India in terms of people listening to the radio?
I mean, US it is for sure, because US is a driving country. You know, people drive long distances to work, and a lot of the consumption is either NPR or whether it's local radio stations. College radio is big in the US as well. So it's a very large market like India, and it has its own sort of micro things to consider. And it's a deep and a big market. So there is all these other things. I mean, so those considerations, and we won't be able to do that. You know, Baba Music can't do that sitting in Bombay. You have to work with people who understand that, you know,
correct,
that region, basically.
Right. And I'd like to touch upon the process once again and understand from you. Do you consciously reject the possibility or shall we say an idea because you've already done it before? Because, you know, as a musician in your pursuit, very often one can repeat things. So it can be repetitive, right?
Yeah.
Or imitative too. So how do you go about making that decision of you know, rejecting an idea which has already been done before in terms of your work?
So if you're speaking of, you know, if you're speaking of like the last few projects which are kind of all different, if you're referring to that,
correct,
then I think my personal tastes are also quite varied. You know, you could say musically schizophrenic because I grew up listening to a lot of different music. You know, so that for me it's also to do with what kind of music you grew up listening to as a kid versus what kind of music you kind of listen to as an, you know, teenager and then an adult. A lot of times you listen, you know, most people grew up listening to one music and then stay within that music. And
correct,
you kind of, you know, that becomes the sound of your sort of your soundtrack of your life.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like that for me at all, actually, you know. So I was listening to music very deeply when I was a kid. And then I, when I became a teenager, that's when I started having serious thoughts about, you know, being a musician. And okay. I picked up my instrument when I was 16. And there were certain, you know, like albums that you could call, like, which changed my, which were triggers for me to listen to music differently, you know. So, and because of that, you know, that kept evolving. Every few years, you would listen to something and that changed. And it continues, and it continues to today. So my tastes are actually, what I do in my own music is a reflection of, you know, me sort of playing homage to, you know, all those different influences that are there. So there is this whole different side of me, which is, you know, as a singer-songwriter, which I haven't really even begun to scratch the surface for, which I intend to do in the next project, for example. So, you know, and writing songs and singing and, you know, producing songs is something which I've always enjoyed doing. And I've done it a lot for my commercial work. I haven't had the chance to, for some reason, I've been a bit shy about doing it. But I intend to change that now. You know, next year, you'll be seeing a lot more music from me, which is going to be completely different from Voyage, you know, okay. which is a different side of me completely. So Voyage is sort of, you know, me wanting to, you know, pay sort of homage to my more, you know, music, muso and jazz rock and jazz fusion and those influences. So, and then there is also this other side, which I love film and I love cinema. And then I have another project which I'm working on right now, you know, with this amazing flautist Naveen, who's an incredible flute player who plays with everybody from AR to, you know, a lot of films. So I'm working on another project, which is very going to be very cinematic and sort of ambient.
Nice.
So there are a lot of different projects in the pipe, and sort of this record label that I set up last year is kind of a pipe for me to push out these personal projects of mine, which have been, you know, have been in the pipe for a very long time, and they've been kind of, you know, shoved down and or pushed back because of my commercial work, you know. And unfortunately in Bombay, when you have to make a living and do your own, you know, you have to make a living, you have to kind of make commercial music, which always takes precedence, and it always basically, it just happens, so happens that you land up, you know, pushing things down. You're like, nahi yaar, let's do it later, we'll finish it, you know, next year. But now I think post COVID, it's been I think for a lot of musicians that I speak to, every, you know, it's been this case where everybody wants to finish, or rather do everything now, because now is the time, right? I mean, everyone realized it was sort of, you know, it's like now or never. So if just to go back to your question, I think the fact that I want to do different things, or I don't repeat myself, is more to do with having all these different influences and wanting to kind of, you know, finish, or rather do things which are more interesting to me, you know, have been interesting, that I've not been able to accomplish or do yet. So yeah, lots to come.
I like how you've made this entire album like a narrative, right? Giving them this sonic palette with which is bound with Indian roots, and then of course the varied influences that you spoke of, and blending them together in your own style and not being imitative is an art in itself, and you've done a commendable job when it comes to that. I must compliment you for making it your own, or owning it, you know, owning this piece of music and keeping it original, right? Yeah. which not everyone can do.
It's I think that is the number one thing for me, you know, and it's being original. Like, you've actually nailed it. That should be the number one thing for most musicians, really.
Right.
And it's always been the case for me, right from my first band. You know, we used to have a band called Chakravyu back in the 90s, which was like this, you know, rock band, when we played this kind of progressive rock sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, you know, I started writing my own music within the first year of me playing guitar. And it was, most of it was quite bad, actually. Mm. It was not good. I mean, I wouldn't listen to it now. But the important thing is that I was composing, whatever you want to call it. It was my own creation. And I think there is something interesting that happens when you write your own music, which is that you kind of start finding yourself and you're finding your voice, you know. And there is sometimes, for a lot of musicians, there is a little bit of, you know, reticence in trying to, you know, sort of tap at that door and try to find what is it that you are really like and what is your sound. Because for most musicians, they are kind of, they are, I mean, we all are actually, we are all are a product of what we listen to. And and sometimes when you listen to something for too long, you kind of start sounding like an imitation or a copy of that. And it happened to me for a long time, actually. You know, like I grew up listening to certain guitar players in the 90s, like Scott Henderson, for example, is a great guitar player. I had, you know, the opportunity to study with him in MI. There was a time when I used to listen to so much of Scott Henderson, you know, I started sounding like him, and it was terrible because the first time I met him was when I went to his class in MI, and I was embarrassed to play in front of him because I had nothing to say. I had no vocabulary of my own, you know. But I think it takes time. These things evolve, and you have to, but you have to knock on that door, and you have to kind of keep, you know, working on it. It doesn't happen. It does not happen automatically. You know, you have to write a lot of music, and most of it will be bad. Some of it will be mediocre, and then some things good will come out of it. So being original should be the number one priority for any musician. I mean, how original you are, that is not for you to decide. I think that it's better if other people tell you that, or I think that will be answered, actually. That question will be answered. But I think it should be, for me, it's always been important to write, you know, writing my own music.
You also mentioned that you pursued your education at MI. And I believe at a later point, you were also given a scholarship at Berkeley, right? So I want to understand what made you pursue music education formally at MI? And also another layer to the question, how much of a contrast did you see in terms of the music programs at Berkeley versus MI? How different is it, or how different was it for you?
They're very different, actually. The entire approach to teaching music is quite different. I'll give it to you in a snapshot right now for anybody who's interested. So right. MI has always been, I don't know how it is now, but it's always been a more activity or rather guitar-based schools. You know, it's more about playing your instrument, really.
Right.
And not to say that Berkeley doesn't encourage that, but I think what I found is Berkeley is more academic. And they both served two different functions for what I wanted at that point in time. When I was in my teens, I wanted to be the best guitar player in the world. You know, you want to be a shredder. And I grew up listening to all the shred music from the 80s, you know, all the shrapnel stuff. And we had a gang in Bombay. We all listened to the same music. And we were all like basically wanted to be amazing guitar players. So my journey to MI was to fulfill that and to also learn more about the instrument and kind of put... basically learn music theory and learn all the stuff, because I was playing all this advanced stuff because I was listening to all this advanced music, but I didn't really know what I was playing. And so it kind of made it, I went there and in those, you know, in the time that I spent there, a lot of things came together for me. And I got the opportunity to practice like an insane amount of time. You know, I was almost playing for like 7-8 hours a day at one point. And it was great because it sorts you out and that practice that you do, you know, in those, the time before MI and the time, you know, during MI, it's, you know, it fulfilled my sort of my guitar sort of ambitions that I wanted to do. But then somewhere down the line, you know, music changed. In the 90s, music was evolving and, you know, sort of, if you want to call it post-Nirvana or whatever, guitar was not as much in fashion anymore. And I also, by some, you know, strange coincidence or whatever, I started composing more for film at that point, you know. So I had a partnership with Ashu, and we started, you know, we were working as a team, and we did a lot of film work and film and advertising. And so the guitar took a backseat because I started writing more music, and I became more interested in sort of songwriting. But I also still felt that, you know, that kept gnawing at me, that I needed to, you know, study more. And I was more interested in harmony at that point. So I just applied to a scholarship to Berkeley just out of, you know, just, I said, let me just try. Who knows? You know, it was not really something I intended to do. But then I got it and I was like, oh God, okay, I've got it now. So I must do something about it. And then, you know, it was just lying there for 3 years, actually. I couldn't go. And then finally I got a letter saying that you have to come now or it's going to get canceled. So I went to Berkeley to study purely, you know, harmony. I was more interested in studying, you know, reharmonization and, you know, studying arranging and all that. So It was a completely different reason for going there. So from my experience, you know, that was the difference between MI and Berkeley, in Berkeley, because Berkeley is also in Boston, and the culture in Boston is so much more, you know, lack of a better word, pedantic. It's more sort of academic, and it's sort of, it's more that, because it's kind of, you're in this company of all these great colleges, you know, Harvard and Boston U and all this. So it's the culture there is slightly more different. I also went like quite late in my life, actually. I was like 27, 28 when I went to Berkeley. I was already working. I had a full blown career. So I couldn't go for too long because, you know, we were like busy here. We were and this is a few years before we set up Blue Frog. And we were we were peaking. We were doing so much amount of work at one point. And so to take that kind of time out was already quite crazy. I mean, first of all, when I went there, I was the oldest guy in my class. You know, all the kids were like 20s and in their teens. So, and they were like, why are you here? I mean, what are you doing? You know, just like, it was a bit like that. But I enjoyed both the schools, you know, and everything I learned. I had great teachers there, and I thank them for everything they've taught me. I mean, that's one thing about America. They are, it's the education, the secondary or the advanced education, the college education is just fantastic. The way they wrap and they kind of structure everything, it's really, really amazing.
You've also set up your own label, right? So I want to understand about the whole decision behind setting up your own record label and choosing to, push out all your releases under that particular label. In a world that's subjected to digitization and globalization of culture, how relevant was that decision for you?
So the function of the label is in the beginning, for right now, is to work as a funnel for me to release my own music. I needed a pipe through which I can, you know, distribute and release my own music, and also do collaborations. I mean, it's very important for me because I get called to do collaborations quite often, and you know, sometimes other artists who will call me may not be set up to release their own music, for example. And sometimes you'll do a project with someone and they may not know how to release the music. They want to work with you, so they might go and sign a deal with some other label, you know, who, and then you're like, you know, on at the back burner with at some big label. So it defeats all the work that you've done, really. So the function of Wawa Records is to serve as a place that I can, you know, release my own music, do my own collaborations, and then eventually we want to, you know, break new artists. That is the plan down the road.
But
music is digital now. There is hardly any physical copies that, you know, you don't sell physical product anymore. I mean, there are certain, you would argue that there are certain markets where, you know, vinyl is still kind of big. But I mean, those are, you know, those numbers don't really justify putting out, you know, you can't print like 100,000 CDs now. That era is over. So the golden age of selling music product is over now. So everything is pretty much digital. So, I mean, that's fine. And that's the reality of it. So, you know, the intention is really more to create an infrastructure to kind of, you know, push this music out.
And are you planning to have limited physical copies of this new release?
If there is enough interest, I might. I think we're going to go on tour from next month. We are starting to do some live gigs. And I'm going to see what the interest is. From September 2024 is when we start essentially touring. So I think if we do leave India, if we do gigs outside, then definitely we might print some limited edition CDs or maybe vinyl, who knows. But as of right now, no.
And have you already sketched out the plan for this tour? Are you going to be touring in among Indian cities as yet?
No, we are right now in talks, figuring out dates. I have one date as of right now in NMAC.
Oh, lovely.
12th of September. That's the one that's confirmed that I can tell you about. And then there are other dates that we are looking at.
Great. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Bangalore.
Yes, me too. Yeah. It's been a while since I've come to Bangalore to play.
Right. It'd be nice to see the entire, shall we say, ensemble.
Yeah, yeah.
Come together with with all these interesting musicians you've put together.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to the album and understand from you, could you expand on the creation of Diuri?
Yeah.
As to how you've been able to infuse so many intriguing changes and micro constructs when it comes to this particular song.
So, see, Devri was born out of, it's a folk song. The, you know, the parts that Kalpana sings are an existing folk song that are sung by the Devri tribe. So Devri is a tribe in from Assam, and they have their own music. And, you know, so I often jam with Kalpana and, you know, we sort of exchange ideas. And, you know, she came to me with this idea, you know, for this song. And when I heard it, I absolutely instantly fell in love with it. And then, but I felt that the song needed a resting place, like a, either a chorus, if you want to call it that, or a hook or something, which was not there. So it's, the songs are basically verses, you know. So I created this chorus in the song, which is which I'm singing, which is Devri, which is uses the word Devri actually. So so that was my contribution to the melody of the song, and then of course the arrangement itself, which was born out of, you know, a lot of time. So it took a while to kind of construct this arrangement, which has, like you said, so many different, you know, influences. It didn't happen overnight. It took a while to construct it, you know. So I had this kind of idea for, I mean, things are kind of born, you know, they get born in stages, and you listen to something and then that inspires something else. So the first idea that I had was this, the horn syncopation, which was there, which is there in the beginning of the song. So I wanted this kind of a syncopation to be there in the song. And then I started kind of toying with that. And then, you know, the song evolved, and then Illustrate, who's the rapper on the song, was also touring with us during the first voyage. He got involved in the band towards the end. And I wanted to create a space for him to also be on the song. So, you know, I got him on board in the song as well. And the song just kind of kept growing and kept building, and it just didn't feel like it wanted to end. You know, for me, that's the kind of song that you could, you know, you could keep kind of having a, you know, but at some point this song has to end. So the song had actually ended with my guitar solo. That was the original ending of the song. And it was like a fade out. It was like a fade out kind of a ending. But I had this idea of creating this groove at the end, which is sort of more samba oriented and Brazilian influenced, which kind of goes into a jam. And that was purely created for us to have some fun when we perform live, you know. So these are all sort of constructs that I've kind of created. I made these sort of constructs so that we can use these things as sort of putty when we are performing live and build on that and sort of, you know, have fun on stage. Because, I mean, that's also important, right? When you're performing, you want to have some spaces to play. So it's very important for me to have my friends who are in the band to also, you know, flex their muscles a bit, you know, and have some fun. So that was essentially the evolution of the song.
And since we're already in the topic of, you know, the creation of incredible folk music with all these interesting elements, I also wanted to understand from you as to what is the art of arranging music for a platform like Coke Studio. Mm-hmm. You've played a very significant role, I believe, in Coke Studio Season 4. You've contributed to compositions like Nemoli, which blends traditional folk elements with a rap section by Bobcat from the Reggae Rajas. So I've also noticed a similar approach. When I say similar approach, I do not mean to say it's imitative, but a similar trend, right? In terms of Jagao Mera Desh, featuring Blase's rap in Season 3 with A.R. Rahman, and in Rangabati from Season 4 again. So does this formula resonate well in a platform like Coke Studio? Is that why composers go for it? I would like to understand what was your approach behind this particular arrangement and the guidelines for, you know, creating music for a platform like Coke Studio. How do you go about it?
So the Coke Studio that you're speaking of, I did it almost like 9 years back. It was quite some time back. And Coke Studio came to me right after I finished the first voyage, actually. Aditya, you know, who was heading MTV at that time, heard the album and he loved it and he, you know, invited me. But I had only like 9 days or 8 days to finish 3 songs. It was some insane deadline like this because they had a shoot already planned, but they didn't have a composer. Or there was some mistake in their programming or scheduling. So he said, look, I'd love to have you, but you have only 8 days. Can you write 3 songs for me in 8 days? So, you know, the thing with when you get an opportunity like this, you don't want to say no, but you also feel like you're getting an opportunity like this, but you have to now basically pull a rabbit out of the hat to create these 3 songs, which became the part of the Coke Studio. So all those songs were written within 4 days.
Wow.
And it was insane. We worked, I mean, I was working day and night. So Nemoli was the least challenging of them because I already had the melody of Nemoli with me. I'd heard it and I got Ilaji to record the melody. And then I built the arrangement on top of that of melody. And that entire arrangement came out of, I was listening to so much of Balkan beatbox at that point. I wanted to kind of have some of that music, you know. So I basically brought that entire energy of listening to Balkan beat. So Nemoli, if you hear it, and you know, you'll instantly say, ah, you know, you'll kind of say, okay, I know what he's going for. The other 2 songs actually were written within those, you know, also written within those 7-8 days. And the most challenging of that is Arab, which is the flamenco, you know, influence song, which I sang with Master Salim. So that was a very challenging song to compose. That's probably one of the most challenging songs that I've composed because it's a Doha by, not Kabir, sorry. It is, can't remember who's, it is a very, very famous Doha that we found and that we used in the song. And then we had to write this entire Hindi lyric to it, which is like a question actually. So so that was also, that took a while to compose, you know, and then I decided to add one layer of complexity to it to make my life even more difficult, as if, you know, things weren't hard enough. We, you know, I decided to give it this flamenco influenced arrangement. Again, I was listening to so much flamenco music, you know, for the last 8 years before that, right? Everybody from Paco to Vicente Amigo to Tomatito and all those great guitar players. So, you know, having like sort of that music kind of, you know, you sort of are swimming in that music at one point, and then you are looking for an outlet to kind of, you know, create something of your own, which you can call. And so I did it, and but all those things happened really fast. It was not like, we didn't have time to like even second guess anything. Did it, I played it to them. They liked it. They said, go, let's shoot it. And that's basically how the Coke Studio was recorded. It was really done in like 7-8 days.
Right on. you've worked with Ilaji on multiple occasions, and it's been a very enduring relation between the two of you, musically speaking. I would like to explore the beginnings of your working relationship with her, and what has it meant in terms of your personal musical development? What were some of the things you've learned from her, and why is she an ideal collaborator for someone like you?
She is Ilaji, of course. I have known her, or rather, I should say, she has known me since I was a kid, actually. So our families go back a long way. You know, my grandfather and her father knew each other.
Okay.
My mother and her were college mates in Jaipur, you know, back in the 60s. Yeah. And then, of course, when I started working in music, before that, I used to be an actor, by the way, before I did music. Yeah, and I've acted in a few films. And she was in a few of those, you know, Shyam Benegal films that I did. And so she's kind of seen me as a kid. I have known her, you know, of course, she's seen me grow up, literally, you know. And because our families were also close, so she's kind of known me for a while. But then there was this extended period, you know, for 10, 13 years where I started doing music, where we didn't see each other.
Yeah.
And then I started working a lot with Prasoon and Piyush, her brothers, who are, you know, famous advertising directors and creatives. So I already had a relationship with the family for a long time, you know, on a professional, mostly as professionals. And then Ilaji was doing an album in 2002, 2003, which I got, you know, I produced a couple of songs with. And that was the beginning of sort of this collaboration that started. And then, of course, you know, since I've been married to Ishita since 2005 now, you know, because it's like family now. So a lot of times she will just come to me and tell me, okay, I have this idea for this melody or listen to this, you know. And so it's really most, it's quite informal that way, you know, when you're listening to music and that's how music music is really created. It's not so much about being in a studio and, you know, formally creating it, but music is created in people's homes and you listen to something and then you jam with it with your guitar and you kind of, you know, there's this back and forth which happens. So that's how it is now, you know. And sometimes I will call her and say that I have this idea for a song, but I don't have a lyric. And she is a master of, you know, words. She's an incredible writer herself, you know. So she can literally write a song on this immediately. So I really, I'm in awe of people who can do that, because for me, composition is structured improvisation. So, and the ability for a musician to improvise is like super important for me, because I am also an improviser and I understand that that's a very important, you know, skill to have, because it allows you to be fluid and walk into different rooms and be yourself without having to worry, because you always are in a place where even if nothing is working, you'll be able to, you know, do something which is, you know, you'll be able to create something, you know, good, bad or ugly. So she's an improviser at heart. She can, you know, come up with things and, you know, riffs and hooks. And not only me, but her collaboration with A.R. Rahman is also, you know, been there for so many years. So she has this uncanny knack of, you know, being able to create things out of thin air, you know, which I love, you know, I respect that a lot. And it's a perfect, for me, it's great, because for me, my, you know, her command of the language is so strong. It's so strong, you know, that I don't have to worry about that, you know. But in the process, what has happened is that my respect for literature and for the language has gone up like tenfold. So I've learned a lot, you know, listening to her. And it's been great, you know. And because of her, she's also been the gateway for me into rougher Rajasthani music, you know, of course.
Amazing.
It's so rich. And the great thing about Rajasthani music is that every time you feel, okay, now we've heard enough of Rajasthani music, there's so much, you'll hear somebody who will just come and, you know, knock the ball out of the park. You know, that music, and that's the thing about Indian folk music. It is so rich and so deep. The well is so deep. It's endless, really. Sometimes you wonder, you know, where is all this music coming from? But it's really endless. I mean, it's unbelievable. And you have to be born several times to really exhaust all the music that's there in this country. You know, I mean, that's the truth.
True that. I'd like to go back in time, speak a little bit about the very first Dhruv Voyage album. One track that, one among many tracks that appealed to me was Zawi D.
Yeah.
Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Featuring Etienne Mbappe. So I want to know as to how the chemistry evolved between the two of you during the recording process of this particular track.
Yeah. So I met Etienne during Blue Frog. When we were doing Blue Frog, we had invited Etienne to perform at the club. And
right.
And it was around that time that I was also finishing recording most of the first album. And I knew he was coming. So, you know, and Zawidi, the title literally is, you know, a homage to Joe Zawinul, who has been a huge influence. Right. You know, and I absolutely, you know, I'm in awe of him and his music. He's just, you know, one of the greatest composers of the 20th century, I believe. So I wanted that song to, it was sort of my dream to have, like, you know, Zawinul alumni on that song. So he was the first one on that song whom I invited and asked to come. And he came and he heard the song. And I had like a rough melody, which I had sung, which was this thing on the guitar riff. And he heard it and he said, I've got an idea for a lyric for it. Again, you know, being the great improviser that he is, he heard it immediately and he said, okay, let me just try this. And he wrote a lyric to the song, you know, in Dawli, which is his language. And we recorded it really quickly. And then we finished that. And I said, you know what? This sounds amazing. I have another song for you. And then I had this other song, which Raul Midon had sung on the album. And he landed up singing on that one as well. So that's how I met. I mean, basically, you know, Etienne, is, you know, I've known him now for over 10 years now, over 10, 15 years. And but all those things were recorded within one day, actually. Less than one day, 4 hours, I'd say. 3-4 hours in the studio.
Wow.
Yeah.
With your permission, I'd like to play a little bit, a sneak peek of Zawidi for the people of India.
Of course. Please. I mean, the Blue Frog genesis is also a strange one. It's a story of a lot of happy accidents and, you know, being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
The Blue Frog, our intention was never to start a nightclub. Ashu and I ran a company called Smoke Music, which is a music, with one of the first music production companies in India. We had multiple composers, you know, working with us. We were working, of course, with the company. And when we had other people, you know, Sanjay Devecha and Harmeet Manseta and Vivek, who was also a composer. We had different people working through the company and, you know, writing music for media. And we used to work out of a place in my old studio, the first studio in Dadar, in Ranjit Studios. And that place became very small, very fast, because, you know, there was so much of work happening at one time. We didn't have any space. So we were looking for a bigger space. So that's what the genesis of Blue Frog was. And we found this incredible space, but it was too big for us. We couldn't imagine what we would do there. And then one night we were sort of hanging out with Mahesh and Srila. And then we decided to, just out of a lark, we said, why don't we do a nightclub there? That's kind of as a, you know, we were sort of having a few drinks and we just said, why not do a nightclub? And we were sort of having a laugh about it. But then the next morning, we all took it seriously and we kind of met and started sort of talking more seriously about it. And next thing you know, Ashu was on a flight to Singapore to meet a friend of his. And we a few months later, we had raised money, and then a few months later, we were in an agreement with Rahul Akerkar as our partners to do the food. And next thing you know, we had started construction. So over 9 months, you know, the entire project came together. And then while we were still looking for the original idea was still intact, which was to look for a space to expand our music company, which we finally eventually found, few months after we started construction. We luckily, by some divine intervention, found the space right behind Blue Frog. I don't know if you ever came there, but there was a studio. There were four beautiful studios right across from next to Blue Frog, where we eventually moved our production company. So the intention for forming Blue Frog really was very simple. It was to create a space for ourselves so that we could go and hang out and listen to music that we liked. And it was really, the truth behind it was that. And then, of course, nothing works in you can't run a business on such noble intentions. So you have to kind of have, you know, things that you have to do around it to wrap it and construct it in a more business friendly way. So we essentially expanded upon that idea and then created this club, which, you know, not only housed the music that we like, but also then it became this mecca for electronic music and, you know, all this other stuff like stand up and then, you know, slam poetry. And then it became, you know, all these different movements actually started from there. They started because we had an amazing team. We hired some really fantastic people who worked with us in the early years, who were true, like, you know, they were like troopers like us, who also had very, very, you know, genuinely honest intentions for what we wanted to do. We wanted to change the scene in India. We wanted to change the scene in Bombay. We wanted to make a difference to, you know, to the city. So that really was the secret intention, was to create something for ourselves. And in the process, we created this beautiful
ecosystem.
Exactly. So, and it became a place where, you know, everybody used to come and hang, and it was wonderful. Actually, it was amazing. But like all things, you know, eventually come to an end. At that point, like 9 years or 10 years into, you know, running that place. But before that, of course, we expanded Blue Frog. So Blue Frog did so well in those early years that, you know, we expanded. We moved to Delhi first, and then to Bangalore, Pune, and all that. But eventually, the rents just complete. Basically, there was so much money at one point in coming into, you know, the F&B space in India that basically there was all these VC money that was coming in, and VC money is essentially, you're not really responsible for making profits in the first few years. That's generally the purpose. You pump in money into startups so that they can stay they can basically expand, and you can't compete with that as a mature business, because, you know, mature business rely on being profitable, and we couldn't compete with the rent essentially had tripled at that point. We got outbid, and also at that point my career had completely, you know, I was so deeply involved in music at that point. It became very difficult towards the end
to
be involved in both the things. I mean, there was a long time where I was involved, but it became increasingly difficult for all the partners to be, because we all had other things that we were doing, you know, as our gigs, main gigs. So, you know, in a nutshell, that's the story of Blue Frog. And of course, those 9 years, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of stories.
Correct.
Of which we'll need a separate podcast
to
get into. And there's some amazing stories of some amazing experiences and, you know, people that we met. You know, the first 3 years of Blue Frog, you know, I saw close to 700 gigs.
My goodness.
Of world-class artists, like everyone from John McLaughlin to Boogie Wesseltoft to Imogen Heap to Nitin Sawhney to there's so many, Mike Stern and, you know, Sylvain Luke, and there were so many great musicians who came through the door.
Richard Bona also.
Bona came multiple times. Yes. So, you know, it was amazing. I think I hope that somebody can do it again. You know, our cities need more venues. Mm-hmm. That's one of the important things about, you know, the music culture in India, for the culture to evolve into the next stage. You need a strong system of having lots of venues. You need it. Otherwise, you can't do it. You can't create music otherwise, because musicians need a place to go and play. You know.
Since the industry is so competitive, have you ever stung by jealousy or competitiveness of your colleagues as composers? Has that ever happened?
Not that I know of. I mean, I really wouldn't. I tend not to also think about these things. I mean, you know. I mean, if it happens, I'm completely oblivious to it.
So in the interest of time, I'd like to come to the last part of our agenda, which is a very quick rapid fire.
Okay.
So shall we get started?
Let's do it.
All right. What's that one song that always makes you cry?
Oh, gosh. What is the one song that makes me cry? I'm sure I'll think of one. There is one. I know. I have to think about it.
All right.
I'm sure there is one. Let me come back to this one.
Okay. On the contrary, what's your favorite guilty pleasure song?
Guilty pleasure song. Anything by Bryan Adams. Okay. I mean, you know, I think he's great. All the stuff that he did in the 90s and 80s is all fantastic. Yeah. Beautifully produced also. Mutt Lange, I think, produced Bryan Adams, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
Yeah.
What are the top five qualities of a composer that you personally embody?
Top five qualities?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me try. Originality, of course. Consistency, important. Originality, consistency, also restraint, important skill to have. Then I think having good instincts is important. You're hired mostly for your instincts. Yeah, you know, it's important to have good instincts. And having a sense of humor, I guess, not taking yourself too seriously. Have you done five?
Yeah, we are.
Okay.
What's your favorite cuisine?
Cuisine. At the moment, it is Japanese.
Okay.
I can have Japanese 7 days a week.
Amazing. If you had to put together an all-star Indo-Western fusion band, you can pick artists from any era, dead or alive.
Ooh.
Who would be a part of it?
My gosh. Okay, so this is where the restraint part comes in. Otherwise, you're going to make a kichiri of it. Let me try. Joe Zawinul, of course, on keys. I would say, who would you have on bass? Jaco on bass. I mean, you know, he's the original. You could have... This is a tough one because it depends on the song. See, the thing is that you can't put a band that plays all kinds of music. But let's try. Okay, let's try. Horn section. Okay, we can have Michael Brecker, of course.
Okay.
Then we can have Roy Hargrove. Okay. Now I'm picking people who are not there. I know, sorry. But I mean, you know, these are all the greats. But there's Chris Potter, also, of course, who's a master. Drummer. Okay. Very difficult. So many great drummers. My gosh. Aditya, you put me in a spot here. Very difficult. Who would play drums in this band? Let's just pick... Steve Jordan, just because he's got incredible time, you know, he can play in a way which is like really straight without too much of, I think Steve Jordan is great. Also, they've not played before. I mean, you know, you wouldn't imagine Steve Jordan.
Correct.
So let's just do it for fun. If you have to have an Indian singer, who would it be? I think Shankar is great. Shankar Mahadevan, he can sing any kind of style and he's an incredible improviser. I don't think anybody can improvise like him, and he understands all kinds of music.
Yeah.
He's great. Guitar player. If this band were to have a guitar player, Who would play guitar in this band? I would love to say Holdsworth, but I don't think Holdsworth would be able to be, play in this band. He's the greatest, according to me, he's the greatest guitar player. But you need somebody who's slightly more, who can play a little more rhythmically and. I think Scott, let's just put Scott Henderson in there, okay? Because he's played with Zawinul before.
Amazing.
And then what else? What are we missing? Should we throw in one more keyboard player? Just for fun?
Why not?
Huh? this is crazy, dude. Who's a great keyboard player who we can choose alive? Nick Barsh, completely different. Left field.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love his music. And percussionist. Taufik Bhai, great percussionist. He can play different percussion, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's good. Let's stop here. You know, we can go on.
Yeah. What are the top five must-haves as part of your wardrobe collection before you go on tour?
I don't have any wardrobe. I have black shirts. I have lots of black t-shirts and black shirts. That's really all I have. So if you see my wardrobe, it's mostly black t-shirts and black. It's a boring wardrobe, unfortunately. I'm sorry.
Okay. if you had to pick your top three records that you're most proud of, what would they be?
My own?
Uh-huh.
Oh, of course, Voyage 2 for sure. It'll be top of the list. It's just, you know, it's new. I love the first Voyage 1 also. It was special because it was done at a time when I was also discovering myself. And, you know, it was the first time I actually... It was, even though it wasn't the first time I collaborated with, you know, musicians from out of India, but it was... It was done in a way that kind of I was finding my own sound. So let's take Voyage 1.
Okay.
And Distance, my first album, was also, you know, has a special place. A lot of that music was written when I was in music school.
Yeah.
As I was coming out of Berkeley. So it kind of, it takes me, when I listen, if I ever do listen to it, it kind of takes me back.
Super. If you had to describe your experience being on this podcast, how would you describe it?
It's been a deep conversation, man. You made me think a lot. So it's been great. I've really enjoyed it, actually. Great questions. Fantastic questions and very musical. Yeah, so it's been good. It's been great.
I'm glad. And I have one last question for today, Dhruv. Down in the distant horizon, what would you like to be remembered as?
I don't want to think of myself so seriously. I mean, honestly, you kind of hope that people listen to your music and go, wow, this was kind of, you know, interesting and left field. And that's about it. I think I don't want to, you know, think of it any more than that. I think if people listen to my music 100 years from now, that it's in itself is enough for me.
This interview will additionally be aired on Big FM Shillong and Aizawl on the Sunday primetime radio show between 5 to 6 p.m. It'll be out on my YouTube channel, Aditya Veera 1994. And it'll also be streaming on all audio platforms ranging from Spotify to Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much once again, Dhruv. It's been such incredible blessing, honor, and a privilege having you on the show. Do stay in touch, and I'd love to see you live in Bangalore very soon.
Thank you, Aditya. I look forward to our next conversation.